who've been kind enough to come to listen to me, and that is that I tend to talk in a low voice rather rapidly, which is a habit from which I cannot altogether cure myself of, for want of trying it. Therefore, if people at the back cannot hear me and wish to hear me, on that assumption, I would be grateful if they indicated this by some mild eccentricity of behavior, such as lifting their hands or shuffling their feet or otherwise displaying signs of slight impatience and irritation, in which case I'll do my best to accommodate myself. I can't promise. Of course, I assume that these words of mine can be heard at the back. If not, these remarks are somewhat self-defeating. The subject which I wish to speak of, which is the Russian preoccupation with historicism, was deliberately chosen not the Russian preoccupation with history, but with historicism, that is to say, with theories of history, with the philosophy of history, with the laws of history, with the patterns of history. And it seems to me that of all, this is one of the motifs which goes through Russian history, particularly in the 19th and 20th century, about which I intend to talk, and therefore has a certain relevance to the kind of atmosphere in which the ideas out of which the revolution sprang were bred. And to this extent, it's not altogether irrelevant to the general subject of these lectures. But I have to admit to you that even if it were irrelevant, I should still be talking about this subject. The real point I wish to make is this. I should like to begin with a paradox which I have stated before, and if anyone thinks that it is false or exaggerated, I should be grateful if somebody would take me up during the question period. The proposition is this. It appears to me that as far as in the region of social and political ideas, and in general, so to speak, outside what might be called the range of natural sciences or exact ideas, the Russian people has generated no original ideas at all, of any kind. This is a startling statement in a way, but I know of no exception to it. You might say, perhaps, that the idea of the Mir, or the idea of the, so to speak, the village commune, has a certain originality, but the Poles claim even that. Some might think that non-resistance to evil, as preached by Tolstoy, had a certain originality, but this, after all, was a Christian idea to which he gave new force and life, and which he would certainly not claim to have originated. What I think is typical of the Russians is that, at any rate, in the period in which I speak, which is the beginning of the early 19th century, is that when ideas do come to them from other sources, let us say from the West, they genuinely look upon them with fresh eyes, undisturbed by any kind of intermediate media. They see these things face to face, so to speak, and not through spectacles of tradition or through spectacles of any kind of convention. They see them very freshly, and if they think them true, they believe in them, and since they believe in them, they, so to speak, act them out. They take them seriously. This is a very rare thing. An idea which is taken seriously is transformed. And in the history, I think they transform ideas which come from the West, I don't say out of recognition, but give them flesh and give them a certain kind of concreteness which makes them dynamic and makes them new, and in this form they ricochet again to the West in a renewed and, so to speak, in some sense, altered form. This, I think, is in some sense the cultural function, if you like, of the Russians in the 19th and early 20th century. If you say, ask yourself why this is, well, there are many explanations, and I can advance some of the more familiar of these, which I dare say will be familiar to you, and if they are truisms, I apologize. You must remember that there is no scholastic tradition, or very little, in Russian culture. Unlike the West, the Byzantine Church, which created the great, so to speak, which drew the great curtain of the great religious schism which divided Russia and the Balkans from Western Europe, did not really contain a scholastic or intellectual tradition anything at all like the West. Consequently, there is in the Russian Church no tradition of logic, no tradition of learning, no tradition of elaborate scholarship, no tradition of sort of intellectual exertion. There is holiness, there is sanctity, there is dedication, there is mysticism, there is a great deal of holy living, but very little intellectual effort, with the result that there is no Reformation, there is no Renaissance to speak of. And because these things didn't occur, because there was no Renaissance, because there was no Reformation, there is the absence of what might be called the kind of glacis, the kind of incline of which you will find in Europe, particularly after the Reformation, where you have a kind of graduated scale at the top, the most educated, the sharpest intellects, the most distinguished intellectual forces, and then by gradual descent you come down to the ignorant and the uninterested. But intermediately there are all kinds of classes of persons in various stages of literacy. This, broadly speaking, was not the case with the Russians. At all periods, there never was more than a small elite at the top and a vast mass of ignorance, poverty, and lack of interest below. And in this respect, they do differ for various social and historical causes, which I am not really competent to go into, from the West. That is one thing. There is no intellectual tradition, and therefore, so to speak, there is no general climate of what might be called ideas. Secondly, I think, of course, these facts are very familiar, and I apologize for even mentioning them. The great breach which Peter the Great made, which we know about, took the form, as you know, of sending young men into Europe. This was the biggest and, in a way, most successful effort at violent modernization made in modern history before Lenin, or perhaps before the Japanese. The young men went, they went to France, they went to England, they went to Denmark, they went to Holland, they went to various, to Germany, to various countries of the West, in order to acquire the arts and the sciences of the West and come back and apply them in this vast and barbarous land. The very fact that they learnt these languages, the very fact that they went through these arts, the very fact that they obtained, by a rapid process of forcing, injected into them the various arts and crafts of the West, with which they were not familiar in Russia, itself, in some sense, divided them off from the great mass of the people in Russia. And they became a kind of educated elite, cut off by the knowledge of foreign languages, cut off by the new habits which they acquired, cut off by their very education from the vast, weltering mass of peasants over which they were set and which they were told to govern, to organize and to govern. And so you already get in the 18th century this curious phenomenon of alienation or cut-offness, in which you get a small group of persons, inspired by Western ideals, cut off from them almost to the degree to which the British governors were cut off from the Indian masses in the 18th and 19th centuries. Almost that. They hardly spoke the same common language with their peasants. They hardly spoke common language with the governed. And so you get, again, this vast gap between the small governing group and the vast mass of persons governed by them below. And this creates a very peculiar situation. You get a barbarous land with no real tradition. First, as Chardaev was afterwards to say, wandering Slavic tribes. Then acceptance of the heritage of an already ossified, already decaying Byzantium. Then the fearful disaster of the Tatar invasion, which shuts them off, shuts the whole thing for centuries, two centuries at least. Then the gradual climb back into some kind of normal political existence, having none of the advantages of the slow and comparatively organic and healthy development of Western countries. And the schism added to that, which cut them off culturally, so to speak, from the West as well. You have this group of persons sitting on top of this vast nation, trying to govern it. You have an attempt to push them through various stages in a very rapid and sometimes very brutal fashion, which Peter initiates, which bogs down to some extent in the middle of the 18th century and loses its tempo. You have educated persons who read French, who read German, who read European languages, who imbibe the progressive ideas of the West, who read Montesquieu, who read Voltaire, who read Rousseau, who meditate applying this to Russian conditions, who realize that Russian conditions are recalcitrant, that it's impossible to apply these ideas in a country which is so unmanageable, this vast mass for which these ideas were not created and to which these ideas cannot be simply applied. And you get a double result. On the one hand, a kind of disillusioned cynicism on the part of people who know where the truth resides, are enlightened in their ideas, know that the average principles according to which their country is governed are reactionary and probably inefficient, accept the heritage of the West, but are disillusioned, unable to apply them to their own country, and fall into a kind of curious cynical detachment. You have this curious phenomenon in the 18th century of the educated Russian nobleman who reads Voltaire and Montesquieu and Helvetius and Holbach and in some sense believes them. He does it on the one hand, he does that. On the other hand, he whips, he serfs, and lives a perfectly brutal feudal life on the other. And these two things in some way conflict. Either that, or you get the few idealists who try and alter matters and are punished for it. Where the parents are cynical and disillusioned, the sons are filled with guilt. This is an invariable phenomenon. Where the parents are in some sense insincere or broken, the sons do not grow up in a straightforward fashion. And this, I think, is on the whole true of the generation, of the younger generation, of the more enlightened and morally more sensitive persons who grow up, who are born, roughly speaking, in the 1770s and grow to manhood in the 1790s and a little after. You then have, of course, the great phenomenon of the Napoleonic Wars, which suddenly thrusts Russia into Europe. This vast giant suddenly appears, at once despised and feared by Europe, regarded as barbarous, regarded as, in a certain sense, as dangerous, at the same time bound to, at the same time vast and powerful, with the biggest army at that time in the world, so to speak, and a curious combination of a feared, despised nation filled with a vast inferiority complex versus the West, at the same time with a kind of wounded pride against Western slurs, the snubs, and the obvious contempt and obvious distrust which the West feels for it. And this is a very complex condition to be in. The Russian officers make their famous promenade to Paris in 1814-15. They come back imbued with comparatively civilized and liberal ideas. They are... The very conditions of army life brings them into closer contact with our peasant brothers, about whom perhaps most of them had not given any thought to, had thought before. This creates a sense of, at once, solidarity with the Russian people, which is part of the general patriotic afflatus of a patriotic and defensive war. And the actual physical proximity with these peasants from whom they were by social conditions kept apart earlier, it creates at once solidarity and a fearful guilt. A fearful guilt about the vast gap which obviously reigns between them, socially, personally, morally, between them and the unfortunate, ignorant, suffering, squalid masses over whom they are set. And this is, I think, where the seeds of that famous guilt, of those famous repentant noblemen, about whom Russian novelists in the 19th century write, really begins. This, I think, is roughly speaking the introduction, the brief introduction to the general, what might be called moral and intellectual condition of the educated Russian classes at the outset of the 19th century. You must understand that the position is one in which, you see, in civilized countries, in France, let's say, in Paris, ideas are knock up against each other. There are a great many theories knocking about at the same time. There are socialist ideas, conservative ideas, liberal ideas, clerical ideas, anti-clerical ideas, various explanations about the failure of the French Revolution, various ideas in favor and against the French Revolution, all kinds of theories, doctrines, and doctrinaires meet in the salons of Paris and to a lesser extent of Germany. These ideas knock up against each other and therefore create what is called the climate of opinion. None of these ideas in themselves become dominant. Everyone who hears or reads about these ideas is at the same time assailed also by other ideas which to some extent offset them and neutralize them. Russia is a huge vacuum, a great, fresh nation, unexhausted, powerful, eager, conscious of its own inferiority, eager to learn, with no culture of its own to speak of, to fall back upon, with a wounded pride and an attempt to make out that perhaps their history is not quite as gloomy as some people might suppose it to be, or not so empty. At the same time, natural respect for these Western values, reaction against the Western contempt for them, or Western grandeur, or Western disdain, with very few ideas that speak to compare with other ideas, so that if any idea wafts across, if somebody brings a book through the censorship, if somebody expounds something which he'd heard spoken in some salon or some café in Paris, this encounters no resistance, and these ideas grow and grow. They grow like, so to speak, to a far greater height. They become much more dominant and obsessive than they are in our countries of birth. And this is what makes the Russians peculiarly susceptible to the influence of ideas, sometimes very fourth and fifth-rate ideas, which in the total absence of other ideas, in this kind of vacuum, grows and becomes an enormous factor in their intellectual development. Hence you get people who read Saint-Simon, who read Fourier, who read Proudhon, who read other French writers, mainly French socialist writers, or the most exciting writers of the time, but also, of course, German idealists and the like, and who then proceed to try and live them. You see, nobody ever tried to live the ideas of Fourier in France, but in Russia they did, with the result that some of them were condemned to death. This is unusual. I think Fourier would have been astonished to hear that people, so to speak, in some sense prepared to face death rather than give up Fourierist ideas. He no doubt would have been delighted, but also surprised. He certainly didn't expect, although he was a monomaniac and believed in his ideas perhaps with greater fury and greater intensity than almost any other thinker who ever lived, this was more than anybody in France could have hoped for. The same is true of Saint-Simon, the same is true of these other French thinkers. Dostoevsky was condemned to death for this. He didn't suffer it, but he was condemned for it, and so were the other members of the Petrashevsky circle. Saint-Simon was exiled for reading and for preaching Saint-Simon. Not merely Saint-Simon, all kinds of minor, fourth-rate thinkers. Whoever read Pierre Leroux with the attention which the Russians gave him? Whoever read Des Amis or Cabet with the attention which the Russians gave him? Any little book which appeared to them to contain the truth, was fallen upon with absolute passion. Herzen has some very interesting ironical pages, partly ironical, partly affectionate, describing this phenomenon, in which these books used to arrive, they used to arrive secretly in the double bottoms of smuggled trunks, and they used to be almost torn from hand to hand. The pages used to drop out of all kinds of 19th-rate German metaphysicians, all kinds of 13th-rate French socialists, which were believed in, suffered for, adored, and which altered people's lives. This is a somewhat exaggerated version of a phenomenon which undoubtedly occurred at that time. Now, there's one more thing I must say, and that is the impact of the Romantic movement upon the Russians in this period. Now, I must apologize to you, I can't compress the contents of the Romantic movement in 2 or 3 minutes, as I now propose to do. The only point I wish to extract from this vast wealth of ideas is this. Certainly, towards the end of the 18th century, there arose in Germany a general movement of ideas, according to which each nation, each group of human beings, each association of human beings was bound to each other, not by mere ties of utility, not by mere ties of self-interest, but by some so-called organic connection, whereby people belonged to each other, and in virtue of that were called one nation, or in virtue of that were called one culture, or in virtue of that were called one church. Some stressed the links of language, some stressed the links of soil, some stressed the links of common heritage or common tradition, but the general idea which is so familiar to us now, of what might be called belonging to a group, was something which was largely invented by German thinkers, particularly Herder, towards the end of the 18th century. Whenever a nation or a group of human beings finds itself in some inferior condition versus some other group of human beings, perhaps whenever it's too strong a generalization, attenuate frequently when this occurs, there is a tendency on the part of the group which feels inferior, which hasn't got the resources or the success or the reputation or the hopes and prospects of a more successful group, the inferior group, the less happy group, tends to ask itself what its prospects are, whether perhaps it hasn't got something with which it can, as it were, offer, or with which it can oppose the claims of the dominant group. The French are obviously the great dominant culture of the European continent of the 18th century. And the humiliated Germans thereupon have inevitably to invent something of their own in order to preserve any degree of pride, any degree of dignity at all. And so you get this notion that the French are superficial, the French may have all the success in the world, the French may be dominate politically, they may dominate financially, they may dominate culturally, they may be the lawgivers of literature and of the arts, but they are simply cold, superficial, atomized society, the last relics of a collapsing Roman regime, Roman culture, on the way out. We, the Germans, may not have all these advantages. We may not be rich. Our poetry may be inferior. Our literature may not be as famous or as important. Our financial and political arrangements may obviously be far more far inferior to the great centralized state of the French. But we possess certain merits which these people haven't got. We possess inner life. We possess depth. We possess seriousness. We possess a religious outlook. We understand what life is about. We live closer to God. We're altogether more human as human beings than these dried out mummies in the French salons, these abbés with their epigrams, these dancing masters with their polished but hollow phrases. This is, roughly speaking, what might be called gallophobia, which you will find among the great many German authors, roughly speaking, in the 1770s. Roughly speaking, the same phenomenon occurs among the Russians too. The Germans pride themselves on the fact that whatever may have happened, they at least did not have a destructive French Revolution. And they didn't have this revolution because they possessed profounder natures and because they understood what human nature was, what human life was better than these hollow Jacobins who believed that political reform and a few ringing phrases borrowed from the works of Rousseau and other revolutionary authors were sufficient to transform mankind. The Russians argued that if the Germans could say that they were superior in avoiding the revolution, the Russians had an even greater claim to such superiority. There's no doubt that whatever tremors might have shaken the German framework during the period of the French Revolution, nothing occurred in Russia at all. It slept profound sleep, and therefore if that was in some sense a guarantee of a deeper nature or a more solid attitude to life, the Russians could take pride in that. It's in a sense a very sublime form of sour grapes in which you say, what they have we don't want. We possess something of our own which is far superior to all these vaunted advantages of the others. And this is a very natural reaction on the part of what might be called persons at some disadvantage. All emergent nations tend to believe this sooner or later. This is a phenomenon with which we are very familiar in the 20th century. Perhaps people were not quite so familiar with it around about 1780 or 1820. That is when the first, so to speak, emergent nations began to be observed as emergent nations, when they began to feel themselves in this particular frame of mind. And the Russians were tremendous candidates for this position. Now, the problem, so to speak, for people of that sort is what, so to speak, they can do. In a world dominated by others, the problem arises, is there room for us? Is there something we stand for? We know what they stand for, because they've made it very plain, and other people accept their hegemony in that respect. What do we stand for? The first Russian author really to raise these points in a sharp, acute, and disagreeable form is, of course, the famous Chardaev, with whom I expect you will all be familiar, who was an army officer, contemporary with, but not all, and semi-involved with the Decembrist conspiracy. He was a contemporary and friend of Pushkin. He was a very elegant, extremely handsome man, of very good breeding and education, with inclinations towards religious mysticism, about whom Pozzo di Borgo, the famous French diplomat of that period, said, "C'est un Russe parfaitement comme il faut." Chardaev could enter any drawing room in Europe and be taken for one of our own. Nothing barbarous, nothing Muscovite, nothing, so to speak, exotic about him. Perfect gentleman in every possible sense. Well, Chardaev, I don't wish to dwell on him too long, wrote this famous, shocking thing called the First Philosophical Letter, which he wrote in 29, but it was published in 35, I think, in 36, in which he tried to examine the problem of what the might be called the purpose of Russia was. What the end of Russia was, why do we exist? And he said, we pretend that we're a great kingdom, we pretend that we're a tremendous empire with all kinds of magnificent and enviable attributes. Our history is nothing. Nothing but these wandering Slavic tribes, Byzantium, Tatars, Poles, foreigners, crushing tyranny, nothing but ignorance, misery, and the knout. That is our history. There is no. We haven't even a language in which to express ourselves properly. Everything we have is borrowed. Why do we exist? What is our purpose? If what the Romantics say is true, is roughly the argument, and every human association is created for some purpose, has some kind of mission, has some kind of inner structure which directs it towards fulfilling itself in a particular manner which belongs to it and it alone, what is our purpose? What is our, what is called das Aufgegeben, what is our mission in life? On the assumption that God creates nothing without a purpose, and that every human nation, every human race, every human association is some kind of ingredient or element in some general harmony, what do we contribute to this harmony? And he says, it's difficult to say. We're like the blank page between the Old and New Testaments, nothing is written upon us. Perhaps we were created as a caution to show nations how not to exist. Perhaps we were created for the purpose of showing how development was not to occur. And then he goes on from there to say that the great disaster is, of course, the schism, that if only Russia had been part of the general Western development, conducted first in the Roman Empire and then by the Roman Church, she would have done better. But unfortunately, she was relegated by the schism into a period of complete non-development, so to speak, and that is why it was crushed, it was miserable, and it had nothing to live for. Well, these are very violent words. He goes on like this. I mean, the thing about Chardaev is he is really the beginner in the great tradition of breastbeating of all Russian writers. There are three elements in Chardaev which afterwards go resounding through the 19th and part of the 20th century. The first element is this breastbeating element. We are miserable. What is our purpose? Perhaps it's none. Should we exist? Would it not be better if we had never been? What is our purpose? It's difficult to discover. Perhaps we're nothing. Perhaps we're detestable. Perhaps they're right to hate us. Perhaps there is something wrong with us, and so on. The second element, which is closely allied with it, is a kind of narcissism, in which the main preoccupation of the Russians is Russia. The main preoccupation of all Russian writing is, what are we for? Why are we here? What is our character and what is our destiny? This becomes an absolutely obsessive element. For example, among the great Russian novelists. If you read the novels even of so Western a writer as Turgenev, and certainly if you read the novels of Dostoevsky, and certainly if you read the novels of almost anyone else writing in Russia in the 19th century, both poet and prose writer, but particularly the prose writers, you will find that the obsessive question is always the destinies of Russia, the famous accursed questions. Should we or shouldn't we? Should one join the West, or should one, on the contrary, delve into our own inner resources and follow some unique line of Slav development which is vastly superior to the rotten West? Or on the contrary, should life be lived in sort of manorial houses of the squirearchy on the backs of the suffering peasants, or should something be done, should there some kind of reform be instituted, or even a revolution which makes men equal? Should personal relations be preferred to dedication to public life, or on the contrary, should personal relations be pushed aside so long as hideous public problems, poverty, squalor, injustice, iniquity of every kind, faces us, and so on? The Russian novels, even as I say, the most apparently Western, Turgenev-like novels, are absolutely chock-a-block with contemporary Russian problems. The only subject in which the Russians take a true interest in the 19th century is Russia and the fate of Russia. Sometimes, when there are men of universal genius like Tolstoy and like Dostoevsky, this has vast implications for humanity at large, and therefore the readers don't altogether notice. But if you read it carefully, you will see that self-preoccupation is an absolutely obsessive element in Russian writing to a far greater degree than in any other literature in the world, both for better and for worse. Chaudhaev posed these questions. As I say, the breastbeating begins there, the self-preoccupation begins there, and, of course, also the attempt to answer it, because in his, after this famous tirade was published, denouncing the Russian past, denouncing the Russian present, and predicting no kind of future, he was declared officially mad by the government. Count Benkendorf, as you probably all know, who was the head of the secret police of that particular period, produced the official line, which is, our past was splendid, our present is magnificent, and our future transcends all possible belief. This was the official line of the government, and therefore not compatible with the theses of Chaudhaev. A doctor was invited to visit him once a week in order to take his pulse, and otherwise satisfy himself about his mental and physical condition. He was put under what was more or less semi-house arrest, and was much visited by eminent foreign tourists. You see, well, I leave Chaudhaev there. It's a very fascinating, interesting life in many ways. He said a number of other interesting things, but I think they're not to the point here. But in this rather low condition, condemned by public opinion, and regarded in some sense as a kind of madman and a traitor, he produced a second work in which he said, perhaps our barbarism has something to be said for it after all. Perhaps if one has nothing, one will gain everything. Perhaps, this goes back to the idea again that we haven't had a French Revolution. Perhaps they've given everything the West, but they're exhausted. There is something to be said, after all, we're fresh, we're barbarian, we're strong, we have enormous appetites. Perhaps let them produce and we shall consume. They will produce the culture, but we shall adopt it and adapt it and develop it. Let them have had all the sufferings, we shall reap the fruits. And this notion that backwardness itself has something to be said for it, has certain advantages, because you needn't go through all the agonizing stages of building things up through various kinds of historical vicissitudes, through the Industrial Revolution, through all the horrors, but can inherit the fruits of that without going, so to speak, through the original agonies which led to it, then becomes a permanent motif in Russian thought, as you know. That is what is behind the idea that one can avoid industrialism and perhaps make something of the village commune. That is what is behind the thought produced by Chernyshevsky, produced by Herzen, produced latterly by the late Isaac Deutscher, that there is a certain advantage in backwardness, because one can pluck the right fruits of other people's endeavors, so to speak, and start from there, instead of being tied to one's own past by the obsolete machinery and obsolete plant, which one can't altogether get rid of, so to speak, if one is an old developed country like England, Germany, or France. That begins with Chaudhaev, certainly. And therefore, there is a kind of note here. We are the inheritors of the world. We must have a part to play. We have a future. We have no past. We have no present. But perhaps we have a future, because perhaps we are unexhausted. We are barbarous. We are young. We are fresh. And we have magnificent powers. And we shall overwhelm the world yet. The result, I don't say direct result, perhaps this is only a symptom, but anyhow, the kind of atmosphere, the kind of mood of which Chaudhaev was fairly characteristic, was one in which people asked themselves, what is our proper fate? Where should we march? As I say, this is symptomatic of what might be called backward or emergent human societies, that it's not the kind of thing which is asked by others. It's not very likely, you see, every Russian writer asks it in one form or another. You don't get this question among the successful. You don't get Dickens saying, whither England? You don't, in the writings of Stendhal, get the question posed, what are the historical destinies of France? Not really. Not even the writings of Balzac. You don't get Jane Austen asking, What is to be the fate, you see, of the great British people? What particular historical stage have we reached, and what follows next? Which way must this great community face? Should we go to the right? Should we go to the left? What particular fate has destiny in store for us? Because these people are perfectly confident. What they believe to be good is good. What they think successful is successful. They set the tone. It's the others who imitate and who try and pull themselves along who are naturally faced by the question, shall we imitate, shall we not? Shall we be what Chardaev called us, miserable apes, imitating fourth-rate French literature and producing ninth-rate Russian imitations of it? Or should we, on the contrary, try and generate something original of our own? And how are we to do this? And what are we to go back to? And what is there in our history to help us? And so on. This is the question which obsesses everyone. And the kind of answers which the Russians give are tied and intimately tied to some kind of view that there must be some kind of framework. There must be some kind of theodicy. There must be some kind of design in history, some kind of pattern in history, in which the great country Russia, my country, the great country, so to speak, in which I, Herzen, or I, Chernyshevsky, or I, Belinsky speak, must in some way be connected. We must have some part to play, because it's the proposition that we have no part to play, that perhaps we're really, as Hegel supposed, an unhistorical nation. Slavs are destined to make no particular contribution to the great human treasury. This is unfaceable. It's too grim to face. It's too disagreeable to contemplate that. And so you get an attempt in the condition in a country which, in which religion has decayed and never, as I say, had an intellectual tradition in any case, and in which the church in any case was, culturally speaking, a somewhat despised institution, whatever part it may have played politically. You get in a country of this sort a desperate effort to create a kind of ersatz metaphysics, or ersatz religion, or ersatz theodicy, in which you find some kind of guarantee, some kind of promise that if we behave in this and this fashion, we too will make our word heard. We too will be great. We too will fulfill our natures in some splendid and satisfying fashion. And this becomes the prevalent note throughout the 19th century. When, for example, Herzen begins to write his essays on, roughly speaking, on the social conditions of Russia, or what we ought to do and what we ought not to do, when his, so to speak, conscience begins to speak, and he begins to denounce the fearful, iniquitous, squalid, and despotic world in which he lives, the tendency is always to ask historical questions, always to say, has history a libretto? Perhaps it has no libretto. If history has no libretto, what are we to do? Do we invent our own values, or do we find them laid in history? Is there some pattern to which we can attach ourselves? Or on the contrary, is there no pattern? And upon this, a great deal depends, because if we think there is a pattern, then there is a certain sense in stimulating a certain kind of revolutionary movement. There is a certain sense in trying to sacrifice one's life to it. But if you can satisfy yourself metaphysically that there is no pattern, that everything which happens, happens as a result of arbitrary human will, then perhaps some other course of action follows. Belinsky, who is an extremely characteristic example of a tormented Russian proto-intellectual, so to speak, somewhere in the 1830s, 1840s, really does attempt to live through the doctrines of the Germans which he reads. First he lives through Fichte, and then he lives through Hegel. And then he rejects Hegel because the theodicy of Hegel is too brutal and too disagreeable, because it justifies too much shedding of blood, too much torture inflicted by one set of human beings on another. He thinks it's too immoral a picture. If this is how history, what the pattern of history is, then we needn't follow history. Then he becomes reconciled to it, not to the Hegelian picture, but some other picture, and says, yes, perhaps there is a pattern in history. Perhaps industrialism is the thing. Perhaps we ought to become bourgeois. Perhaps we ought to adjust ourselves to Western conditions. Perhaps we ought to reject our peasant past. Perhaps we ought not to listen to what the Slavophils say. The Slavophils, on the other hand, produce another pattern, which goes back to Byzantium, which goes back to the Russian roots, which goes back to some kind of Slav Christianity, which condemns Europe for being divided on the one hand into the decaying forms of frightful Catholic hierarchy, the dead hand of Rome now decayed, a fearful dead pyramid of authority which no longer has any meaning on the one hand, and on the other hand the atomized, disintegrating, utilitarian, dry, completely spiritless Protestantism of the other part of Europe. Only in Russia has primitive Christianity been preserved, which neither crushes people by huge weight of legal and political despotism of the Roman hierarchy, nor by the disintegrating and atomizing laissez-faire individualism of the sadly spiritless and spiritually dry Protestant countries, and so on. But all these people are not talking in the void. This is not idle discussion in the salons. This is not just idle theories. These people really try to live their theories. Their lives are governed by it, and their political action, their particular the causes to which they sacrificed their lives, the risks which they took politically, the prisons to which they went, the particular, so to speak, parties which they tried to form, the defiance which they held of the government were literally founded upon a perception of some kind of historical pattern, because they wanted something to prop them up. If it was only me and my conscience, if it was only something which I've thought of myself, this was too dubious, it was not firm enough. They needed some kind of guarantee that there really was an order in the external world, in terms of which it was possible to say that if we behave in this and that fashion, there will be a holiday in our street yet, as Chernyshevsky said. In Bedinsky's case, it's extremely evident, so to speak. Chernyshevsky, too, always argues historically. I mean, Chernyshevsky adopts this view of Chardaev's about the fact that perhaps the Russians can profit by the industrial achievements of the West without going through the torments. Perhaps there is some route round the horrors of the Industrial Revolution towards socialism, which the Russians alone can adopt. We must learn by the lessons of 1848. We must understand that liberalism is not the way. We must understand that parliamentarism is not the method. We must understand that the real pattern of history is not this, but something else. And then he draws up a kind of pattern of history which he thinks true, and to which he is prepared to sacrifice his life, to which he is prepared to send people to the death, for which he is ultimately exiled to Siberia, and to which he loses his life. These people are genuine martyrs and heroes, and they are martyrs and heroes to their historical perception, so to speak, of what the universe is like. An extremely vivid case of this is furnished, so to speak, by the kind of arguments which they had. I've already mentioned the Petrashevsky group, who believed in Fourier. This was not a particularly historical belief, but a little later than that, for example, you will find not only in the arguments in the Slavophiles and the Westerners, and the arguments in the Slavophiles and the Westerners are not arguments of an ordinary Western type, namely, what is it best to do? Is it better to industrialize, or is it better to remain rural? Is it more healthy to do one, or more healthy to do the other? The argument always acquires a historical form. What are we descended from? What is our nature? To which path of history do we belong? What, so to speak, will develop us along the natural grooves of our historical formation in the most frictionless manner, so to speak? When Western statesmen ask themselves questions, they don't ask themselves questions in this form. If John Stuart Mill asked himself a question about what was best done, he simply put the question in an ordinary moral fashion. What will make people happier? Or what will be more just? Or what will be more efficient? Or what will be better? When Bismarck asked these questions, when Guizot asked questions, when Thiers asked questions, when English statesmen asked various questions, they didn't have to frame their questions into some rigid historical framework, so to speak, so that you can demonstrate the validity of your answers from the fact that it's a stage in some inevitable development which guarantees that it will be a success and will develop your nature in its proper fashion if only you can screw yourself into the right historical framework, so to speak, and not in the wrong historical framework. For the Slavophiles, if you follow the West, you're simply perverting your Russian nature. For the Westerners, if you follow the Slavophiles, you are perverting your nature, you're trying to go back to the past, which is impossible. You are trying to adapt yourself to some imaginary past, which these people thought existed before Ivan the Terrible, which is all moonshine. For Khomyakov, on the other hand, if you try and follow Western patterns, you are trying to follow a path which has already led the Western nations to their doom, and which history has already condemned. So that the notion that history stands there, encouraging and deterring, condemning and pushing forward, is already an extremely fixed idea in, so to speak, in what might be called public Russian thought, in the discussions and the debates between the right wing and the left wing, the individualists and the collectivists and everybody else there is, by 1850 or 1860. Let me give you another fairly vivid example of this. In the 1870s, there was a great debate, as you probably know, between two sections of the Russian populist movement. But on the one hand, between the Jacobins, led by people like Tkachev, who believed in elites of professional revolutionaries, and on the other hand, Lavrov and his followers, who believed in a slower process of evolution and education. This is a well-known debate about which we'll find, or which we'll find extremely useful and summary, both in Venturi's book on Russian populism and in Dan's book on the origins of socialism. Extremely good accounts of this interesting debate, which was really fateful for Russian history on the whole in its results. Now, The argument takes historical forms. You see, Tkachov says, conditions are intolerable. No country is more enslaved, oppressed, and disgusting in every possible way than our great homeland. This can only be remedied by a small group of dedicated professional revolutionaries who do things for the people, not with the people. The peasants are stupid, reactionary, and malevolent. And anybody who ties himself to the peasants goes to his doom. We wish to save the peasants, but of course always against their will. If you listen to what these people say, you will collapse. No body of men is more degraded or, in some sense, more ignorant or more stupid than the vast body of peasants whom we are intending to save. You mustn't listen to what they want. You mustn't listen to what they say. What you must do is save them, if need be, against their will, if need be, by violence. This is the Jacobin, so-called neo-Jacobin doctrine of Tkachov, who is, in some sense, a disciple of Blanqui, and I suppose before him of Buonarroti and Babeuf. Against this, and therefore the program is, form a small revolutionary elite, arm them, and create a coup d'etat. If need be, slaughter. If need be, crush and destroy. And if need be, create a dictatorship which will repel all efforts to overthrow it, if need be for a long time. Against this, Lavrov argues that this isn't right. That although, if this is done, the peasants won't like it, which both sides recognized, as they won't like it, they will attempt to resist it. In the attempt to break their will, even for their own benefit, you will obviously create instruments of repression. These instruments of repression will brutalize you and militarize you, you the elite, the revolutionary elite, and by brutalizing you and militarizing you, they will change your ideas, and instead of becoming liberators, you will in fact become oppressors. And in the effort to liberate the people, you will fix a yoke upon their necks, which will perhaps even be harsher than the one we've just struck off. Fateful words. To which Lavrov replies, you must look at history. Tkachov replies, you must look at history. There is no other way. All successful revolutions are made by small bodies of desperate professionals, and not by so-called huge popular movements, which really never quite occur. Lavrov replies, yes, of course, this is true. There are the Puritans in the 17th century, the Jacobins in the 18th, but then what happened? These were followed by all kinds of fearful collapses, or and certainly in the case of France, by directoire, degeneration, the bourgeois republic, everything we hate. To which Tkachov in turn says, yes, but if you wait, if you try and educate, if you try and make the people democratic, if you try and make the masses of workers capable of understanding what liberation it is that they need and which we bring to them in a sort of semi-Marxist fashion, which Lavrov preached, then you will find that the state, as so often in the past, the analogies are always historical, as so often in the past, will simply buy off your revolution intelligentsia. Where do we get our best cadre from? We get them from engineers, doctors, agrarian experts, students, the frustrated intelligentsia of the towns. If the Russian monarchy has the least degree of wisdom, they will simply offer the doctors practices, they will offer the scientists laboratories, they will offer the agricultural experts land to develop, they will make conditions perfectly peaceful for them, and in this way they'll drain off their revolutionary zeal. These people will be bought off by the state, and you will lose the only revolutionaries who could help you to upset the system. This is what the French have done. This is what has led to the detestable French Republic. Observe what happened in the 18th century, observe what happened in the 19th, and you will see this is not the path. And so the argument proceeded. In fact, Tkachov needn't have worried. The Tsarist regime didn't display even that minimum of intelligence of which he was afraid. And therefore, exactly what he hoped for, in fact, happened. But the point is, the argument always takes historical forms, and they always ask themselves, what stage have we reached? Are we now like the Puritans of the 17th century? Is this 1789? Is this 1793? Is this Thermidor? Is this 1815? Is this 1848? Where are we? What stage have we reached? As if there really is some kind of calendar. As if there really is some kind of objective order of development and the great things to discover on what particular step of this particular ladder you are in order to take the next step and not make some awful mistake and fall off the ladder altogether, which can happen. Or at any rate, which can retard your progress. That is why, you see, if you conceive of the Russians as in some way obsessed by constant historical analogies, which to them are a kind of theodicy, which to them are a kind of metaphysical framework which guarantees the next step, so that if you learn where you are on the map, you can then and only then take the next step. And the map is a rationally intelligible map, some kind of symmetrical map, which really does not merely indicate how the past has gone, but gives a certain principle for the future too. If you see that, then you will see upon what very fertile soil Marxism fell when it finally came to Russia. It was the country of all countries, paradoxically enough, which was readiest to receive this particular doctrine. And of course, the intellectuals who received it with colossal enthusiasm. And you once again have this phenomenon of arguments always in terms of some kind of historical framework. Plekhanov, who I suppose is the most influential of all Russian Marxists, begins always by considering what stage have we reached. Given that Marx is right, and that there is a certain order of events, first we have feudalism, then we have the collapse of feudalism, we have the early development of capitalism, then we have later developments of capitalism, we have generational proletariat, and so on. Where are we? Have we reached what might be called late 17th century England? Have we reached early 18th century France? Or are we somewhere behind or in front of these? And the argument proceeds exactly on those lines. The populists are wrong, because the populists don't understand that the historical development of Russia, this inevitable stage must be passed. We must generate a proletariat, otherwise we cannot have what is called a modern revolution. We cannot have socialism, because Marx understands the laws of history, and these are the unbreakable laws of history. You will see how vivid this is when you consider, for example, this famous letter, which you know about, which one of the Russian populists addressed to Marx in the early 80s. Late 70s, I can't remember, 79 or 80 or so, in which Vera Zasulich asks Marx whether perhaps it is possible, in his opinion, for the Russians to avoid the horrors of industrialism and a huge exploited proletariat, whether there might not be a direct path from the village commune directly into some kind of socialism, avoiding the awful corridor of industrialization and exploitation of the Western type. To which, of course, Marx, naturally enough, answers at first rather impatiently at first. Really, what are you asking for? You are asking me to exempt you from the laws of history. I can't do that. Like a schoolboy who says, I can't. You can't leap over these stages. I mean, this is not a... this can't be arranged. I mean, in effect, he's implying is either his theory is serious or it's not. If his theory of history is serious, he can't arrange for special exceptions from inexorable historical laws. Nevertheless, you must understand that at that particular period, only Europe was in a condition of, certainly was not in a condition of any kind of revolutionary upheaval. There was not much revolutionary activity going on in the late 70s in Europe, certainly after the commune and so on, everything subsided. The only persons who were doing anything at all were Russian terrorists who actually were killing governors, meditating killing an emperor, which they finally succeeded in doing. And Marx was always predisposed towards effective men of action. These Russians came, and although they weren't exactly Marxists, they were heroic, they were dedicated, and they adored Marx. And in the end, the old man somewhat softened. And he wrote them a letter in which he said, well, there are, of course, what I really wrote in Capital about these matters is really meant to apply to the West. I wasn't really thinking of Eastern Europe at all. But if your, so to speak, the revolution in Russia coincides with the general revolution in the world, particularly in the West, if your revolution touches off a larger revolution, or anyhow a larger revolution bears you upon its shoulders, then perhaps there isn't any necessity for you to go pedantically through all the stages of European development for the purpose of making your own revolution, but borne aloft by the general wave which you might even stimulate or attenuate, of which you will form a part. Therefore, on condition that there is a general revolution, you might skip this particular stage, but not otherwise. This letter was so incompatible with what Plekhanov at that time was preaching. And he was preaching at that particular period, as you know, that the Russians must accustom themselves to take history seriously. It was no good trying to leap over stages. It was no good running about with bombs or killing governors or attempting deeds of isolated assassination before conditions were ripe for a proper advance of the proletariat. Either we shall make a revolution with the workers or we shall not make it at all. Therefore, the proper task was not to indulge in individual terrorism or agrarian dreams of some kind, or some kind of William Morris-like dreams about some happy rural Russia, which avoids the horrors of industrialism. That was a mere piece of utopian reaction, utopianism, however worthy. What we must do is actually almost help the capitalists in their task of modernizing or transforming Russia. That is to say, the proletarian stage must be gone through, and the faster, the better. And therefore, we must really drive the capitalists, in a sense, faster against the reactionary state into the proper route, which is towards greater and greater industrialization. When this letter was received from Marx, which made it held out a ray of hope that this might not be necessary, that if a revolution broke out, let's say, in France or in England or in the West, there might be no need for all this, all these horrors. Plekhanov was deeply upset, and he decided to defend Marxism against Marx. In short, what he did was to suppress the letter, which was published, I think, for the first time in about 1923, when it was no longer of very great contemporary importance. Now, my point is not whether Plekhanov was right or wrong to suppress this letter. Many people cannot forgive him for it, and he's regarded as having committed a great breach of revolutionary integrity and so on by doing so. This is not the point. The point is, no other socialist would have had to suppress a letter of this sort. If a letter of this kind, upsetting preconceived ideas, had been sent to Monsieur Jules Guesde, who was a French Marxist, or to Karl Kautsky, or to Bernstein, who at that period was a German Marxist, or to Marxists in Belgium, or to Marxists in Holland, or even in England, or even in Italy, it wouldn't need to be suppressed. But in Russia, it had to be suppressed. He was perfectly right. Because these people believed faithfully, deeply, first of all, in the existence of patterns of history, and secondly, in the existence of experts who knew what they were. Some people thought it was Saint-Simon, some people thought it was Buckle. Some people thought it was Darwin, some people thought it was Marx. The Russian writings of the 19th century teem with statements which begin, Spencer says, Buckle says, John Stuart Mill says, you might want to refute it, but you will always begin with some great Western authority before whom you have the profoundest respect. They know, we don't know. They are the experts, they are the people who know. They have studied the patterns of history, these patterns exist, and there are certain specialists who know what they are. And therefore, if this letter had been allowed to leak out, the Russian Social Democratic Party might have been profoundly demoralized and might then have ceased from organizing itself in the particular fashion which it had to organize itself, and young men, so to speak, would have gone on sacrificing their lives in vain efforts to perform terroristic acts, and needless blood would have been shed by people who were far better employed, in, as he thought, in reading the works of Marx and quietly creating the conditions of a mass party among the workers. I only bring forward this example because I wish to explain how literally minded the Russians were, how literal they were, and how much importance they attached, so to speak, to what might be called ipsy dixits of this sort, and to documentary evidence for the existence of a framework which alone justified a specific piece of political action. Nowhere else, except perhaps now in the 20th century, I can't tell you, perhaps in Asia and Africa it may also be so, I wouldn't know. But certainly at that period, nowhere else was there this literal faith, so to speak, in dogmatic pronouncements about the unalterable shape and order and progression of historical steps. The same thing can be said even about Lenin. The great arguments which went on in the 90s always took this form. Marx said that we can't make a revolution until certain conditions are fulfilled. For example, until the majority of the population are, roughly speaking, industrial workers, something of that kind, until we now have a majority of industrial workers who understand their historical position. Well, in 1890, this didn't look very real in Russia. And yet Lenin was an impatient man, and a man who wished to make a revolution soon rather than late, and therefore had to go through extraordinary stratagems in order to prove that, as a matter of fact, and he tried to prove it to himself in the middle of the 90s, Russia was already in condition to make a revolution, because all Marx said was you needed capitalist development of a certain kind. Now, peasants were capitalists. 80% of the Russians were peasants. Therefore, 80% of Russia was capitalist already. Conditions were ripe. He didn't insist on this very much after 1902. I mean, he receded from this position. But the mere fact that he had to produce this highly eccentric hypothesis, and apparently believed in it profoundly, is evidence of the fact that there were these continual arguments, so to speak, about the calendar, about the timetable. Where have we got to? In 1905, there was a continual argument with Plekhanov and Lenin about the timetable. Are we, so to speak, in 1848 or are we later? Should we make a revolution now or shouldn't we? What is the condition of the proletariat? Have we reached stage 3 or stage 17? You are only allowed to make a revolution when you, according to the book, when you've reached such and such a stage. The question is, have we or have we not? Because if you make it at the wrong moment, Engels said, if you get into the power at the historically wrong moment, and there is an absolutely rigid progression of these moments, then woe betide those who do it, because you will in fact find yourself in a place very different from that where you intend to be. The situation in 1917 was exactly that. When the Mensheviks argued against the Bolsheviks about what kind of revolution they wanted to make in 1917, this is the hub and nub of the argument. The hub and nub of the argument is constantly exactly that. Are we or are we not ripe? The whole notion of ripeness, you see, all these things which are now called imperatives of modernization or imperatives of industrialization or takeoff points, things of that sort, begin then. There is an objective order and one must know exactly what point one has reached. Where do we take flight? Where do we leave the ground? We must judge the moment absolutely precisely, and you can discover it by some kind of huge intellectual operation, by observing history, discovering its laws, and identifying your place upon the great historical ladder. That is, I think, what I mean by the Russian obsession with history, historiography, which is, as I say, a kind of theodicy, a kind of ersatz religion, equally, so to speak, powerful, equally influential, equally important in the thought of all these thinkers. One thing I must add before I stop, and that is, it's fair to say that not all Russian thinkers were equally obsessed by it. I gave the impression, perhaps, that most Russian intellectuals in the 19th century thought like this, and of course a great many did, but some certainly didn't. For example, Bakunin never did. Bakunin was an anarchist who thought you could make a revolution anywhere at any time and with equal success. All you needed was some desperate men and enough to upset the given regime. All you needed was a group of desperados with no stake in existing society prepared to go to all lengths. He was perhaps in some ways a frivolous man, but it has to be, I think this could be said without injustice, imaginative, interesting, become a frivolous man who didn't really take himself all that seriously, certainly not as seriously as his followers took him. But the doctrines of anarchism, which he initiated in a big way, so to speak, in Western Europe, never did take root in Russia, partly for this reason. The anarchist movement in Russia was always feeble. It existed, but there were never very many anarchists. They flew a black flag, and in the end, Trotsky exterminated them all. But as a movement, they were small, they were inconsiderable, they were idealistic, and they were essentially non-Russian inspiration. They really looked to various Western thinkers quite consciously. You could say that Tolstoy was anti-historical, and I think this would be just. The interesting thing about Tolstoy, about whom I don't wish to begin at this hour, is this. Not so much that he didn't believe that historians understood history, and he didn't, of course. As you know, the most famous remark which Tolstoy made about history was that history always tells us things we don't want to know. She says history is like a deaf man answering questions which nobody has put to him. It gives us answers to all kinds of trivial questions, whereas the great questions of human existence they carefully leave aside. But apart from this, he was an 18th century thinker who thought that all men were ultimately made of the same substance, with certain permanent, great moral and intellectual questions which could be answered by anyone if they simply ignored the sophistication by which they were surrounded, asked this question in a simple, sincere fashion, and really made a great effort to arrive at a truthful answer. The point about Tolstoy is not that his views, in a certain sense, were directed against this view of historical pattern. The point is that he had to come to terms with it. No other great novelist needs to add to his novel, whether historical or otherwise, a huge excursus making quite plain what his attitude is towards history, sociology, metaphysics, determinism, freedom of the will, and so on. In the 1890s, let me give you another example, the early Russian Marxist Peter Struve, who was at that period Lenin's friend and a great inspirer of Russian Marxism, was terribly worried about the problem of free will. Now, free will is, of course, a problem which has worried thinkers from the days of Epicurus onwards, perhaps, you see, and preoccupied the thoughts of many philosophers and many common men. But in the case of Struve, the problem arose, if history is determined, why need I sacrifice my life and, so to speak, and take the risk of being shot, hanged, or taken to Siberia? If everything is going to be inevitably all right anyway, if history moves my direction, perhaps it will take a little longer, why should heroic young men have to suffer the most terrible risks and face the most appalling dangers? And if the party is going to believe in determinism, perhaps their hands will falter and they will no longer be as energetic and as heroic as necessary. And so Struve says in all solemnity, maybe the populists have something in what they say, because the populists are always arguing that everything is determined. Why be heroic? Why take risks? Why not just wait for history to take its course? everything is going to produce a happy ending at some time or other. He says, well, let us say that 90% is determined, but 10 is free. You see, this isn't the kind of discussion which used to go on between Sidney Webb and Graham Wallace. It didn't happen. This isn't the kind of thing which Mr. Jules Guérin was talking about to Jaurès. This is not the way in which these people spoke. Why they didn't speak is another question, but it is of crucial life and death importance to the Russian Social Democratic Party whether the doctrine of determinism or, on the contrary, the doctrine of limited free will was true. And this had to be argued out night after night in heated discussions by these intellectuals, who were not merely intellectuals, but persons who in the end were responsible for the Russian Revolution. That is the point which I must impress upon you. And that is why Tolstoy, who was anti-historical, if you like, had to make his cryptic bow before this. He had to come to some understanding with it. He had to explain that he was against it. He had to make some kind of statement, come to terms, and not simply ignore it. Flaubert didn't have to write about history. Dickens didn't have to write about history. Maupassant and Zola didn't have to write about history. Nobody else did, but Tolstoy felt a certain inner necessity, and Dostoevsky did also. The only other class of persons of whom it can be said firmly that they were not obsessed by history were the historians. On this note, I think I should perhaps almost like to end. These persons who were pursuing empirical researches into history were on the whole least liable to be infected by the thought that there was some shortcut, there was some huge, so to speak, pattern which one had to find before one could set to work. In the elder son of Joff's work, you still find certain Hegelian notes. The historian Chicherin is some kind of Hegelian too, but these are not the most eminent Russian historians. The great Kluchevsky, the historians like Platonov and Kareyev, and all the non-Marxist historians of the 20th century are exactly like their Western brothers. They simply write history as they find it, with whatever categories, whatever concepts appear to them to be the most useful in, so to speak, describing and accounting for events. They are the class of persons least affected by this metaphysical obsession. But politically speaking, and socially speaking, the persons upon whom the destinies of Russia turned out to rest, that is to say, the socialists of the right and the socialists of the left, the socialist revolutionaries and the cadets, all argued in terms of this framework to a degree, with an intensity, with a fanaticism, with a devotion, which is totally different, it seems to me, from any similar discussions in the West. Something of the sort happened in Germany in the 1840s, 1850s, but nothing as profound as this. You don't find even the Ranke, you don't find even Treitschke, you don't find even in the historical jurists, even in Savigny and persons of that sort, this kind of literal belief that if only we can discover what the pattern is, then we shall be saved. And if we don't discover what the pattern is, then we shall be doomed. And this seems to me to be a persistent note in Russian history from the beginning to the end. And that is why, among other things, that the Marxism found such marvelously fertile soil in that country, and that is why these ideas, which were born in the West, once they came to Russia, became transformed out of all recognition and became the movement and led to the consequences which we all know. Thank you very much.